Hello again, and welcome to the Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. On today's show, you'll hear a session from our Canada-Taiwan Relations webinar, which took place on August 17th. This webinar was made possible thanks to the support of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's strategic sponsors, Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics, as well as the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office. Now you'll hear Meredith Lilly, Eric Miller, Hugh Stevens, and Deanna Horton on how Canada could develop closer economic ties with Taiwan. Deanna is an old friend and colleague and a CJAI fellow with extensive service in Asia, twice in Tokyo, including as our deputy chief of mission and as our ambassador in Vietnam, as well as assignments in Washington and Hamburg. Deanna has also served as a fellow with the Asia Pacific Foundation, the Wilson Center, and the Monk Center.
Well, thank you very much. And it's a pleasure to be moderating this very exciting panel. You can find the bios of the panelists on the CGA website. And I would also encourage everyone to read the three excellent papers that were put together by the panelists. So I'm just going to briefly introduce them. Eric Miller is a president of Rideau Potomac Strategy Group. This is a cross-border consultancy. And he was previously Vice President of Policy North American Cybersecurity at the Business Council of Canada, but I actually know him from his service at the Canadian Embassy in Washington, where he worked on a number of trade policy issues. Meredith Lilly is an Associate Professor at Carleton University, where she holds the Simon Reisman Chair in International Affairs, focused on trade policy. Dr. Lilly previously served as Foreign Affairs and International Trade Advisor to Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, responsible for negotiations with the European Union, South Korea, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, among other files. Hugh Stevens is Vice Chair of the Canadian Committee on Pacific Economic Cooperation. He's a distinguished fellow at the Asia Pacific Foundation of Canada, executive fellow at the School of Public Policy at the University of Calgary, associate faculty member in the MBA program at Royal Roads University. And following a long career in the Foreign Service, Hugh was senior vice president, public policy for Asia Pacific for Time Warner based in Hong Kong. So I think if you look at the papers, all of you to some extent, because this is an economic discussion, has focused on Canada and Taiwan's accession to this CPTPP. So it's been said that China would be welcome to join the CPTPP, which of course presents a much higher level of ambition than RCEP, of which China is a member. And that was finalized in November 2020 at an ASEAN meeting in Hanoi. So going back to the TPP, if Taiwan were to join, which is what you are suggesting, how do you think that would affect China's eventual accession? And do you think this would also impede the chances of the USA eventually joining CPTPP? So if we could start perhaps with Eric.
So as you quite rightly lay out, it's a complex regional map with respect to CPTPP and RCEP, the alphabet soup of trade policy. So the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership has 11 members, 8 have ratified to date. But Taiwan has certainly made clear that it wants to join. Now, when we look at other regional processes, we see that Taiwan is a member of APEC. When we look at global processes, we see that Taiwan is a member of the World Trade Organization. And so, in essence, there is an established practice of having Taiwan engage within these multilateral trading processes. And because trade is ultimately about economics, the idea would be to bring Taiwan into the CPTPP process. Now, if China were to join, that would be a profound game changer. Certainly, it would mean that the Japanese would have to agree to China joining. It would likely mean that the U.S. would not come back anytime soon, not that there's any guarantee that they will anyway. Certainly, Taiwan and the United States are edging towards a bilateral free trade agreement. So if that were to happen, having Taiwan in CPTPP and a U.S. re-entry wouldn't be any obstacle. But certainly, if China were to join CPTPP, it would profoundly change the nature and context of the agreement. Now, China sits alongside Taiwan in APEC and in WTO and in other processes. And well, there may not be a particular amount of joy about that process within the context of CPTPP. That in and of itself would not be a challenge if the two were to be a member. But I think fundamentally, the existing members of CPTPP would have to ask the hard questions of, is it desirable to bring China into this forum, or are there other ways to deal with China in terms of trade rules?
That's great. Meredith.
Great. Thanks, Diana. So I don't think China will ask to join CPTPP. And I say that because I think that CPTPP is increasingly regarded as a regional alternative to China-led trade through the RCEP agreement, which has happened simultaneously to the conclusion of CPTPP. And China leads RCEP. And it's a much more traditional trade deal. It's focused much more on tariff elimination, less so on governance elements, state-owned enterprises, currency. These are all the kinds of things that you do see in CPTPP. So if you think about the two agreements, CPTPP is kind of a trade deal with strings attached in a way that RCEP is not. And so the things that are reflected in CPTPP, like governance elements, currency disciplines, standards on labor and environment, those are all things that I don't really think China wants in on that kind of trade deal. But it is the kind of agreement that Western countries want to be part of and would like to, quote unquote, discipline. This is a term that's used in trade, discipline in the region. And so the United Kingdom wants that kind of agreement. The United States wants that kind of agreement. And so it's this kind of focus on standards and governance that I think is actually also the opening for Taiwan to enter TPP in a way that it's not going to achieve that success with RCEP or some other kinds of agreements. And part of that is that, just for audience members that aren't aware, Taiwan is a full and recognized member of the WTO. And so that would allow Taiwan to join this agreement in a way that it isn't necessarily able to join other kinds of non-trade agreements. And so TPP members, current members that are inclined to want to support Taiwan and its democracy project and its sovereignty project, can find a way to sort of balance two ideas together, both the idea of the One China policy as well as allowing Taiwan to negotiate accession to the TPP. And so that would be countries like Canada and Japan and Australia and New Zealand. But there are other CPTPP members that are not going to want to see Taiwan enter out of deference to China. China is a very important trade partner for everyone in the region. And they're going to be looking to Beijing for signals. And so I think the bottom line for Canada is that we really should be taking the position that only CPTPP members and those who are officially seeking to join should have influence on those deliberations. And China, unless it officially seeks to join, and the United States, similarly, should not have an official role or undue influence on those processes unless they seek to join. And I think that is kind of the little tunnel through which Taiwan can find its way in.
Thanks very much. Hugh, over to you.
Thank you, Diana. Well, with respect to China's interest, its professed interest in joining the CPTPP, I agree with Meredith. I think it's highly unlikely. In fact, what China is really doing is laying down a strategic marker. It's not closing the door forever. So by putting that counter on the chessboard, so to speak, it's keeping its options open. It's muddying the waters to some extent. China would not, it is not in a position to accept the disciplines of the CPTPP, and besides which, it's focused, as Meredith says, on RCEP and also on the BRI and other areas where it can more easily control its agenda. So I think, you know, one never say never, and that's what the Chinese are doing in terms of keeping that option open. In terms of Taiwanese entry to the CPTPP, it is problematic. There will be some members of the CP of the current agreement who are less enthusiastic than others. And for Canada, as much as anybody else, it poses a problem because, as was pointed out in the previous panel, we have a de facto one China policy. We have for many years been very careful about that. I mean, I would personally say we've probably been excessively cautious in not reaching out beyond the rails of what we think that policy entails. We do have more scope to develop our relationship with Taiwan, not just on the CPTPP, by the way, but also in terms of doing more bilaterally. After many years, we finally concluded an avoidance of double taxation agreement. We have not yet concluded a foreign investment protection agreement, but we could. We could also do more on the trade promotion front. We haven't had a minister of trade or minister of small business ever visit Taiwan, yet Mary Ng was quite happy to tweet happy pictures of her eating Canadian ice cream in Beijing at the same time that Michael Kovrig was imprisoned just a few kilometers away. So there's more that we can do within the parameters of our One China policy. And that includes doing more on the bilateral promotion, but also in order to get to where we want to be with Taiwan, and it's very much in Canada's economic interest to have a rules-based agreement with Taiwan, particularly if the US pushes Taiwan into a bilateral agreement, that will be trade diversionary. It will affect Canada negatively because we compete with the US on so many issues. So we need to have an agreement with Taiwan. The way to get there is through the CPTPP. We won't, China will object, that would be bluster. But if there is a combined, if the TPP members stick together, if there's a combined effort, if several countries perhaps join at the same time as Taiwan, that will mitigate the pressure and be a way for us to get to yes on this issue.
Can I just do a quick follow-up with you, Hugh, because this was also a question that came up in the Q&A earlier about the FIPA, the Foreign Investment Agreement. So why do you think Canada hasn't managed to negotiate something like that? And also, you know, all of my years in Asia, I was always looking at what Australia is doing. So can you comment on how Australia is viewing Taiwan and what the competition, i.e. Australia, is doing with Taiwan?
Well, the big difference between Australia and Canada and Taiwan is that Australia has a trade agreement with China. We do not. The pattern, if there is a pattern, is if you want to negotiate a trade agreement with Taiwan, you do it first with China. That was the pattern that New Zealand followed. It concluded a trade agreement with China, and then it did. Then it had its own trade agreement with Taiwan. Australia does not have a trade agreement with Taiwan. To be honest, I don't know if it has an investment agreement. It may do, it may not do. I don't know why Canada has been slow. My understanding is that the slow pace is more due to the Canadian side than to the Taiwanese side. I think Taiwan would be ready. There may be some substantive issues that are holding it up, but I just think it's something that hasn't been given a priority. It's been sort of pushed off the side of the desk. And this is something that we should do. There's good potential for Taiwanese investment in Canada. A FIPA would help. We finally concluded, as people know, a FIPA with China some years ago. So I don't understand why we don't do it. We do compete with Australia in many ways. I wouldn't say that Australia has been any more advanced. The Canadian office in Taiwan and the Australian office in Taiwan perform essentially the same functions. Australian politicians visit Taiwan in a private capacity, as do Canadian politicians. What I would like to see is Canada take a bit more leadership within the parameters that we've set for our One China policy. And that would include unofficial visits by senior officials and ministers responsible for economic and non-political type portfolios, functional portfolios. Thank you.
I'm going to turn back to Meredith, going back to CPTPP. You make a very interesting argument in your paper that it might be better for Taiwan to enter into accession negotiations together with South Korea and Thailand, for example. So if you could comment on that. And the other thing is, and this was mentioned in the previous panel, when you look at the level of Taiwanese investment in China, And also, you know, there's been some move by the Thai government pushing Taiwanese companies to leave China. I'd love to hear your perspectives on all of that.
Okay, well, so the reason that I suggest that Taiwan joins with several other countries, and I'm not the only one to have made this point, but it's really that if Taiwan is the only next country to join, it's sort of like just putting a big giant spotlight on this issue, and it runs the danger of being an overtly political China position that all the CPTPP countries would be taking if the only country they're adjudicating is the entry of Taiwan. And so by looking at Taiwan together with other countries, what you can do, the kind of strategy that you're employing there is that you're making this a much more process heavy deliberation. And it's a way to depoliticize the Taiwan-China issue. And it does that in three distinct ways. And so one of them is that it allows CPTPP members to take the position that they're just considering all countries according to a preset set of criteria, and they'll look at each one, and isn't this boring, and we haven't gotten to the final set of, you know, sentences about, you know, these big long proposals to join. And so that piece, by the way, also would help other countries that have politically difficult issues within CPTPP to join. So, you know, separate from Taiwan, there's some kind of Korea, Japan stuff that isn't super pleasant, but if several of these countries join together, they can all sort of set aside those political bilateral issues and treat this purely as economic. The second piece is that for Taiwan, it just kind of lets them tuck in and avoid being the focus of the sole focus of this, which isn't good for Taiwan to be solely set up as a kind of China versus Taiwan case. And then the third piece is that it also gives, and I think it's the most important piece, it gives China the ability to ignore the whole thing if they want. So it actually gives a face-saving strategy for China to say, well, there's just a process happening. There are these whole sets of countries that want to join CPTPP. We think RCEP is better. We're just going to kind of set this aside. I don't think that's what's going to happen, but it creates the opportunity in different ways for everyone to kind of use this as a way to allow Taiwan in. And then one other little piece I think is important to note is that Taiwan really has to do this properly, because one of the aspects around sovereignty that is important is this concept of recognition sovereignty. And so if Taiwan seeks to join and is rejected, that's actually very bad for Taiwan's broader project, not just economically, but with ICAO, with WHO, with all these other things. So doing this in a way that, you know, consulting with other CPTPP countries and asking them, what is the best way to get you to say yes to our joining, and then following that kind of path is a good idea for Taiwan in order to kind of address the broader, longer term game around Taiwanese sovereignty.
Okay, let me turn it over to Eric. In your paper, you do some excellent analysis on sort of opportunities for Canada to grow commerce with Taiwan. So if you could give us a sense of that. Also, everybody's talking about supply chains and the critical role that Taiwan plays in terms of semiconductors, which affects not only what you think of electronics, but also automotive manufacturing. And then just a quick look at opportunities for Taiwanese investment in Canada.
Yeah, so I think there's a great deal of opportunity to focus on growing this relationship. So much of what you hear about the Taiwan relationship is about the geopolitical side of it, but there's also a very real commercial side. So if you look, for example, Taiwan is not unique in this, but they're making a very significant push towards energy transition. So you have a company called Northland Power out of Toronto, which has put in a major wind power installation. Canada exports a lot of coal to Taiwan, but the amount of coal which Taiwan will use in its energy mix going forward is being reduced. And so there's opportunities for Canada to supply other types of products as this energy transition unfolds. Forest products, big area of opportunity as well. We're seeing a great deal of interest in building with wood. Wood is carbon sinks, expertise in that particular area. Certainly, you know, in one area that Taiwan is actually really good at that we don't focus a lot on is on bicycles. They make some of the world's best bicycles. And a lot of these bicycles, people think about the stuff for sale at Canadian Tire for $300, but they're making stuff that retails for $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, particularly the electric assist bicycles. There's a burgeoning bicycle manufacturing sector in Canada. So why is there not an effort to try to put those together? And Deanna, you mentioned also semiconductors. Anything with a plug likely has a semiconductor in it. And so this is really crucially important. Canada is like a lot of countries looking at efforts in the United States to try to grow semiconductor manufacturing there, diversify supply out of China, and to ensure broader availability. There is some semiconductor manufacturing expertise in Canada. And so I think this is an area where Canada really needs to take a hard look and say, how is it that we want to focus Canadian domestic manufacturing capabilities? How do you partner with the TSMCs of the world and some of the big Chinese semiconductor manufacturers? And so this is not an area where there's a quick turnkey solution, because if you're in the business of building a fab in which semiconductors are made, that's a long-term proposition. But I think semiconductors is an area where the two countries perhaps put together a working group and say, this is how we can collaborate more effectively in this particular area. And of course, that then leads to the question of foreign direct investment. Just quickly to finish on the foreign investment side, it was mentioned earlier that the Foreign Investment Protection Agreement has not been ratified. That's something that is important, but I think it's also important to recognize that the political context around Taiwan and Canada relations has evolved a lot over the last few years. And perhaps where there was some reticence in global affairs and other parts of the federal government to push too hard on doing things with Taiwan, I think there's a little bit more momentum for that now. So one could expect in a post-election context that to the extent that Canada is looking to expand its relations with Taiwan, that the Foreign Investment Protection Agreement will be part of that, and that could be linked up with this semiconductor investment and manufacturing push.
That's interesting. I'm just wondering if we're looking, I mean, my research is mostly on the digital economy, so I've been very interested in following what's going on with the digital economy agreements that are in Asia. Do you think this would be another avenue for Canada? And the other thing is APEC. What kind of role do you think APEC could play in terms of the Canada-Taiwan relationship?
I mean, APEC provides a useful forum because Canada and Taiwan are both members. And so, as has been suggested by Hugh and by Meredith, finding ways to essentially use bigger venues to work through bilateral processes that don't serve to put as bright a spotlight on things plays a very important role. And of course, with respect to the digital economy agreements, to me, these are in essence no-brainer sort of agreements. And people have traditionally thought, well, Canada's not as strong in the digital economy. But when you look at the success of people from Shopify to Lightspeed to OpenText, there's a lot of good reasons to be part of this. And Taiwan's digital sector, their mantra is essentially Taiwan inside. So they say, we don't make the external piece with the brand on it that everybody knows. We make the guts of the hardware and the software to make the systems run. And so there's a lot of interesting complementarities there, because Canada, as it's evolving, is more providing the enabling infrastructure for the digital economy. And so putting those two economies together in that sort of a context, I think, could lead to some important synergies.
Thanks, Eric. Meredith, Hugh, any comments on that?
The DEPA, as it's called, this Digital Economic Partnership Agreement, right now is in its very embryonic stage. I think it's New Zealand, Singapore, and Chile. There's a lot of discussion about what will the global rules be for governing digital trade. We have different models, the China exclusionary model, the US model, the EU model, and Canada has to figure this out. We are big players in AI, and personally, I think that participation in the DEPA, which I hope grows, would be a useful platform, and it's something potentially that Taiwan considered joining as well.
Meredith?
Yeah, I fully agree with both of them on pursuing that. I also would just make the point that, Taiwan's semiconductor industry is vital globally. And so there's lots of other countries with very strong views about what happens moving forward with protecting Taiwan's semiconductor industry from takeover from elsewhere. And so, being part of constructive multinational efforts around this, I think is also something that Canada can certainly do.
Yes, absolutely. What about Taiwanese soft power? I think that perhaps you could argue that today is an element of that. But I think in Washington, certainly Taiwan plays a very large role. And I think that there's lots of opportunity to do more. Do you have any other ideas about how this can, the business and commercial and economic relationship, what Taiwan should be doing?
I mean, my own sense, Deanna, is that everybody needs to tell their story, and that soft power is a crucially important and underappreciated dimension. I think when you look at Taiwan's soft power, one of their mantras that they say repeatedly and they seek to live up to is Taiwan can help. And so they have some very interesting infrastructure in place for dealing with humanitarian disasters, for sharing certain critical supplies in the pandemic and things of that nature. I think you could see more on the artistic and creative side that would need to be done, because these are things that send very important signals about societies and how they approach things and their values and so on. And so I think one area that foreign ministries globally typically struggle with is the idea of how do we tell the society story writ large, as opposed to simply advancing agreements and interests and things of that nature. And so, particularly if you're Taiwan in a situation where your political position in the world is contested, taking the Taiwan can help model and expanding it to also Taiwan delivers interesting innovations and lots of different fronts is something that is very, very much, I think, worth doing. And I think this is something that perhaps in the early part of the Cold War, you saw more of from countries, but in the last 20, 30 years, we've gotten away from that. And I think as we're evolving into more of a digital world, an interconnected world, that's something that perhaps everyone needs to think about bringing back more of.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think also on the education front,
yes.
I think that would be important. Meredith, is Hugh, any other comments that you would want to make on that?
I don't have advice for Taiwan about how to do this, because I think Taiwan does it quite well.
I would agree.
And so, from what we saw with the most recent Olympics, you saw a little bit more noticing of Taiwan publicly, which was great in my view. The way that, to Eric's point, Taiwan can help. So during COVID, Taiwan was very forthcoming about sharing its successes. I think on the other side, what we can do is sort of insist on opportunities to give it its own line in the COVID statistics and highlight its separateness and its ability to engage in that kind of diplomacy. So just being, I think, a kind of honest player on the other side of it and giving opportunities to highlight those successes is what we should be doing more of.
Yes, and I think the opportunities on the commercial side need to be more advertised in both countries, I would say. Hugh, did you have any comments?
Well, just to make the perhaps obvious point that a society or a nation's values are a great vehicle to project its soft power. So Taiwan, as we've seen over the last 20 or 25 years, has become really a beacon for rights, for gender equality, for indigenous issues, for many of the things that Canadians profess to express for their values are reflected in Taiwan. Taiwan hasn't done that. It hasn't evolved so that it can use that as a soft power message or soft power vehicle. But the fact remains that because of the way society has evolved, it is a very attractive model that I think it's very active and has been quite successful in promoting.
Yes, and I also think there must be opportunities even for indigenous-owned businesses on both sides to create more of a mutual opportunity, particularly when you think about e-commerce and things like that. I think Canadian companies, as Eric was mentioning earlier, there are a lot of, and certainly the mapping that I do of Canadian companies show that there's a lot of activity by people in the digital economy space, particularly on the services and software side. And you would think that that would be an area that you could also do a focused indigenous opportunity approach as well. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, I think it's already being done to some extent. There have been linkages between indigenous groups, indigenous business groups and cultural groups in Canada and Taiwan. We both have policies that have been less than successful over the years and are trying to grapple with that. So I think there's ample scope for developing that particular angle.
So Deanna, one specific opportunity, and I mentioned this a little bit in my paper, is in the area of lobsters. And so one of the things you saw about a year or so ago was Clearwater Fine Foods, which was a major player in the global lobster industry based in Nova Scotia, was purchased by a group of six indigenous groups that have taken it over and are operating it. And with that comes the very sophisticated infrastructure to get fresh lobster to market globally. And so as you see opportunities not only to sell into China, but also to expand sales into Taiwan, that could be a very interesting leverage to work with some indigenous groups in Taiwan, in coastal waters around commercializing fishery and things of that nature. And then also if the proposals with the First Nations groups in BC come to fruition around purchasing the Trans Mountain Pipeline, that also becomes a very interesting opportunity. And so it's to me, as the First Nations business community in Canada grows, prioritizing helping those linkages with the Taiwan First Nations communities and perhaps partnering with them so that they can grow could be a really, really intriguing area. Because I think certainly there have been meetings between Canadian and Taiwanese First Nations groups, and there's an intriguing sense of we can do more together here. But as things mature in Canada on the commercial side for First Nations, working with the Taiwanese First Nations as close partners is something that I think should be prioritized and serves all sorts of soft power, economic and other interests.
And going back, Eric, to you mentioned we were talking about energy earlier. We have to wind down, but I think that would be another area where you would see some opportunity for collaboration regarding climate change mitigation, adaptation, new technologies, and this would be also opportunities for investment, as you mentioned earlier.
Yep, indeed.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Remember, you can find the podcast in iTunes or wherever else podcasts are found. If you like the show, please remember to give us a rating. It really helps the podcast grow. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI, and thanks go out to our producer, Charlotte Duval-Antoine, and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on the Global Exchange.